Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Babbage on Economist Radio. I'm Kenneth Couquier, a senior editor at The Economist, and coming up on today's show, how the safety of a major gene editing tool is being debated.
When CRISPR-Cas9 was discovered, there was a lot of excitement about it because it seemed to be extremely accurate, as well as not only cheap and easy to use.
And I'm joined by Dr. David Fagenbaum to discuss the first ever World Castleman Disease Day.
Castleman disease is a rare inflammatory disorder that affects every organ in the body, and the subtype that I have is about as deadly as lymphoma.
But first, the European Commission this week hit Google with a record fine of almost $5 billion for cementing its dominant position in internet search by tying it with the Android operating system for mobile phones. On the surface, the size of the fine seems impressive. But does it hide an inconvenient truth? I'm joined in the studio by Ludwig Siegele, The Economist's technology editor, to look at what this ruling really means. Hello, Ludwig.
Hello, Ken.
What exactly has Google been fined for?
We all know Google is dominant in internet search. I think in Europe it's 90%. In the US, it's a bit less. But still, Google is dominant, and this is about Europe. And so the commission accuses Google of having kind of cemented its dominance in internet search by basically forcing smartphone makers and telecoms operators to adopt its Android software. And not just the Android software, but the whole set of other services or apps Google offers, like Play Store, the App Store, YouTube, all these sorts of things.
How, by forcing mobile phone makers to adopt a free operating system, Android, does that help Google's search business?
First of all, it's an open source operating system, and that's also Google's argument. Device makers don't have to adopt it. But if you want to sell a commercially viable device, at least in the West, China is a different question, then you have to have Google Play Store and you have to have YouTube. Otherwise, nobody will buy your phone. Amazon has tried to do that. They developed their own Android version, and I think it was called the Fire Phone. That was kind of a complete flop. And also you have to know, so increasingly, the internet is served on smartphones. It's no longer on desktops. So on the desktop, Google was dominant, and the danger was that it would lose that dominance once kind of computing moves to smartphones. So what it has done in the eyes of the commission, it basically bundled all its mobile software together and said to telecoms operators and smartphone makers, so you have to take this. And once you take it, you have to take it for all your models. So it's basically paralyzing or cementing its dominant position or moving it to the mobile space.
What's the bad practice here? What's wrong by doing that?
Because it limits choice for smartphone makers, and thus kind of limits innovation. You have kind of a counterexample to what's happening in the West, which is China, where Google Play, the App Store, and Google's Android is not available. So that's where smartphone makers can do kind of what they want, mix and match, build their own operating systems. And it turns out that the mobile market or the market for apps in China is much more lively and more innovative at this point.
So the commission has fined Google an eye-popping amount of money. Problem solved, or not?
One could expect that. Yeah, it's a big fine. But if you apportion it over 10 years, let's say, it's less than 1% or 2% of Google's revenues. It's not really kind of, I mean, it hurts, that's true. But I mean, you could also see it as the cost of doing business. Because at this point, at least, it's not clear whether the verdict or the ruling by the commission will change anything in the market.
What is Google's response to this? Clearly, they don't believe they did something wrong. Make a case for why looks different from their perspective.
In these cases, so there's a certain conduct which I described, and that conduct has benefits and it has harms. Of course, the commission focuses on the harms, and that's kind of limiting innovation, limiting competition, that's clear. Google's case is that actually what we're doing is good for the consumer because we allow a very familiar experience when people buy new phones. They kind of they know which type of apps are on there. Kind of there's no surprises. It also argues that if you don't do that, if you don't have those restrictions, the Android platform, the operating system, will fragment, and that has happened before with other open source projects, one has to say. So that's not completely impossible. But the restrictions imposed by Google are really strict, and it's the big question whether it needs to do that or whether that actually, the argument it's good for the consumer is just a smokescreen to defend a practice that effectively, as the commission says, cements Google's dominance in internet search.
Ludwig, thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Next up, gene editing, and in particular, the use of a gene editing tool known as CRISPR-Cas9. Since its discovery in 2012, it has become enormously popular for tinkering with genomes of all kinds, thanks to its ability to make editing cheap and easy. However, the safety of its usage has recently come into question, and I'm joined in the studio by Natasha Loader, The Economist's healthcare correspondent, to understand why. Hello, Natasha.
Hello, Ken. Hello, hello.
Natasha, first you have to explain to the generalist, remind us, what is CRISPR-Cas9?
CRISPR-Cas9 was discovered in bacteria. It's a defense system, a sort of little molecular defense system that they use to chop up bits of invading viral DNA. And when it was discovered, it was realized that this little set of molecular tools could be used to edit other things, other genomes. And the way to view it is a sort of pair of molecular scissors with a sort of GPS on it. And the GPS can be programmed, so you can say to this particular molecule, you can say, I want you to go to this particular location in the genome and cut. And you can use this basically to make very precise edits to genomes.
And it's being used in certain places clinically, but we should be concerned about it.
When CRISPR-Cas9 was discovered, there was a lot of excitement about it because it seemed to be extremely accurate, as well as not only cheap and easy to use. This led a lot of firms to jump on the technology as a way for developing therapeutics, different kinds of medicines, cancer treatments, treatments for genetic disorders and things like that. What has happened in the last year is that there have been a number of papers which have sort of brought into question the accuracy and fidelity of the method and raised questions about whether the tool is as good as we originally thought it was. So that's the backdrop to what's going on at the moment. And sort of this week, there's been another paper which has found that this tool, CRISPR-Cas9, can generate all sorts of unexpected changes near the sites where it's cutting DNA.
So there's a trade-off to be had between all the beneficial uses and some of the negative side effects. What are some of these negative side effects?
One way of viewing this is, as you say, that there is a trade-off between the sort of use of the technology and the benefits and the risks. Another way of viewing this is actually what we're starting to see is the CRISPR-Cas9 tool being really characterized more fully and really understood. What's become apparent from some of these studies is that a lot of the effects that we're seeing are likely to be context dependent on the type of cuts you're making, dependent on the cells you're using. And none of this really says that any of the clinical work should stop at all. What it says to us is that we need to be careful when we're using this tool to make sure that the kind of genetic changes that we've made are the ones that we intended to make. And so what we see in these studies, that we have seen in these studies, is not necessarily being replicated in the laboratory. And also remember that before a medicine goes on the market, the people who make them have to sort of demonstrate that the treatment does what they say it can do. And so the fact that we're finding CRISPR-Cas9 can have some unwanted side effects doesn't mean that it does in all situations, or that when the sort of eventual treatments are on the market, that they'll be unsafe. None of those things are implied by this. It reminds me very much of what happened when we got very excited about another technology called RNA interference. And there was this sort of huge wave of excitement and everyone was like, oh, this is amazing. You know, we're going to be able to interfere with RNA as it moves through the cell and we're going to be able to treat all sorts of diseases. And everyone started chasing the technology. And then there came a kind of oh dear moment when it was realized you couldn't get the sort of technology into cells very easily. And so there was a long period. It's the trough of disillusionment. I mean, we see it all the time with technologies, the trough of disillusionment. And it should come as no surprise that that's what's happening now, is that you're going to see these papers coming out saying, wait just a minute, you need to think about this. And indeed, we do need to think about these things, these potential problems, and how we're going to solve them or minimize their effect.
Natasha, that's excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
So what are your thoughts on the safety of gene editing? Or on the European Commission's record fine of Google for almost $5 billion. Tell us in an email and send them our way to radio@economist.com or on Twitter @economistradio. Finally, July 23rd is the first ever World Castleman Disease Day. It aims to bring together all the various people connected with the deadly disease. Though Castleman disease was discovered more than 60 years ago, there's very little known about it and it has no cure. Last year at Babbage, we spoke to Dr. David Feigenbaum. Several years ago, he had been diagnosed with the disease himself, and the medical establishment didn't have any hope for him. So he became his own patient, and from his hospital bed, he was able to identify a treatment that would eventually save his life. But since then, he has led something called the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, which innovates around how to do drug discovery for the disease. Dr. Feigenbaum is joining me on the phone to update his progress and tell us about World Castleman Disease Day. Hello, Dr. Feigenbaum.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
So first, let me ask, what is Castleman's disease?
Castleman disease is a rare inflammatory disorder that affects every organ in the body. Basically, your immune system attacks and shuts down your vital organs. It's about as common as ALS, and the subtype that I have is about as deadly as lymphoma.
And why did you decide and others decide to create a day around it?
It's so poorly understood, and unfortunately it's so deadly because so little research has been done. We have started a movement back in 2012 to try to accelerate research and drug development for Castleman disease, and we began really focused on physicians, scientists, researchers working together. What we realized as we moved forward is that we scientists can only make so much progress, and we realized that we needed to bring together the full community, and so we brought in patients and loved ones, and more recently it's just become clear that we can't do this on our own and that we need to bring in the broader public.
Now, one of the interesting ways in which you're trying to tackle the disease is to innovate around the process of innovation, of how you actually study it and come up with cures for it. And you've created the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, the CDCN. Tell us about what that is and why it's innovative.
The CDCN is taking a very different approach to research. Traditionally, research organizations raise money and then they invite researchers to apply for the funding to use it how they see fit. It's an approach where you basically hope that the right researcher applies for the right project at the right time. It's very much reactive. Our approach, we decided to take a different one, and that's to begin by building a community, to create a network of individuals that knew about the disease, that they could think critically about the research to be done. And then once we built that network of patients, researchers, physicians, then we went back to that network and we effectively crowdsourced from them what are the research studies that needed to be done. And then we went out to identify the best person in the world to do it.
And has there been any successes in this method?
We've had a few. I think the one that I'm most proud of and most excited about, in the early days of the CDCN, we prioritized a particular study, what we call Unlock the Cell Study. And that study used various techniques from flow cytometry to immunohistochemistry to really try to critically investigate cell types and signaling pathways in Castleman disease. And when we pulled together all of those different techniques and pulled together all the data, we began to identify a signal within the data. And this isn't a signal across all patients, but within a subset of patients for a particular signaling pathway called the mTOR pathway. And what we were so excited about as we began to uncover a potential role for mTOR is that there's a drug that targets mTOR. It's called sirolimus. And I was one of the first patients studied in this way. I'm a physician scientist and also a patient, and decided that I would try this drug myself. The drug had never been used before for Castleman disease, but it's FDA approved to treat patients that have undergone kidney transplants. It's an immunosuppressant antidepressant, and it targets mTOR. And so I started myself on it about 4.5 years ago based on this crowdsourced, collaboratively developed research. And I'm really excited to share that it's now been 4.5 years since my last relapse, and the longest that I've ever gone. And now, based on my early success, we've now got in the works to launch a clinical trial of this same drug in other patients. And I think that this is what we wanted to do early on. We wanted to identify the right studies, get the right people to do it, and then identify meaningful findings where we could actually apply them to humans and patients right away, with the hope that maybe there were drugs that already existed, so we didn't have to go out and spend 10, 15 years and lots of money to develop new drugs, but we could actually use drugs that already exist that maybe are approved for something else.
David, when we spoke to you last year, you mentioned how the CDCN could be a model for other diseases. Since that time, has anyone picked up the torch and carried it forward?
Yes, there are a number of groups here in the States, and I imagine internationally as well, that are taking on what we and they call the collaborative network approach. It's the term that we've coined to describe the approach that we take to research of building communities, crowdsourcing, and then recruiting investigators to do research. And that is one of the things that maybe I'm most proud of, is that we're obviously making progress for Castleman disease. We still have a long ways to go for Castleman disease. This drug's working for me, and it's worked for a handful of other patients, but we know it doesn't work uniformly across Castleman's patients. We know that there are a lot of work to be done, but the idea that our work for Castleman disease, this deadly disease that's horrible, could actually have an impact on many other diseases is something that I think is really exciting and something that I'm very much interested in pursuing further.
That's great. David, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thrilled to be a part of this.
If listeners want to support the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network on World Castleman Disease Day on July 23rd, you can go to cdcn.org. And that's all for this edition of Babbage. Don't forget to pick up the latest issue of The Economist or find us online at economist.com. I'm Kenneth Cukier in London. This is, oh, you know what it is. It's The Economist.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.